This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about estate and income tax planning, primarily to keep your taxes low and keep you legal. And here to lead us in that discussion is Tom O'Rourke, principal at Miles and Stockbridge law firm, kind of all over the place, right?
Yeah, we got offices throughout Maryland and in Tyson's Corner, yeah, Bob.
All righty. And Tom, I always introduce Tom the same way. Tom got me into this probably 35 years ago with a call, said, Bob, would you like to come on the air? I didn't sleep for 3 weeks. And Tom just was masterful at keeping me calm, and we've got through the hour, and here we are, scant 35 years later.
And we're still getting through the hour. Thank you very much, Bob.
All right, well, and thank you. So, actually, you got a question this morning already, and it's a young couple, and they have a young child, and they want to make certain that the child is cared for should something awful happen to them. So we got things like wills and we got powers of attorney. So let's start off with that. It's probably a perfect entree to start at the youngest, and then we'll work to the eldest.
Well, the one thing I tell young people with children is even if they don't have any money at all, they need to provide some mechanism for caring for their child. And the one thing that every couple with children needs is they need to have at least a simple will that names a guardian for the child. Now, the other thing that I often find is although many times young couples don't have much in the way of financial resources, they do buy life insurance to provide for the eventuality of what happens if we're gone and we leave a child behind. And many times I suggest to these couples that they also include a trust in their wills that would be funded by the life insurance that pays off when they die, and name a trustee to manage those funds for the benefit of the child.
All right. Can I just ask you some basic things?
Absolutely.
A trust is kind of like it's not an artificial person, but it holds an asset.
That's right. Many people equate it to a bucket. It is a bucket into which you place resources and you draw on those resources when you need to do it. And the person that makes the decision about when to take assets out of the bucket to be used for the benefit of the beneficiary is called the trustee.
Okay, and a trustee should not be elected other than very carefully. In other words, it should not just be a friend. It certainly can be a friend, but it ought to be somebody that can stand on their own 2 feet and say no to the child when they want a Corvette at 16 rather than college later. Or if somebody else, an aunt, uncle, challenges something when they're very young that the trustee didn't expend the money. But the trustee really is there to make sure the money lasts.
Many times when people hear the word trustee, they think I'm talking about a bank or a financial institution and a lot of money. Well, that's really not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a responsible adult, just like you said, somebody that needs a car to commute to college. And what you need to tell them, you don't need a Porsche to go to College Park or to Northern Virginia Community College. Maybe a 2003 Toyota will do the job. You just want somebody who's going to act in the place of a responsible adult if mom and dad aren't there.
Okay, how do you make this airtight, other than by coming to you? for the people outside the Beltway that might not, you know, somebody young, somebody not young, wants to make sure that whatever is set up is somewhat airtight and it can't be challenged by somebody that would have ulterior motives?
Well, in anything that me or anybody else would do can always be challenged. It's real easy to file a lawsuit in this country challenging something. Many times, it's a complete waste of time if it has been done correctly. What you need to do, what it's always advisable to do, is to have a lawyer who does a lot of work in the field of estates and trusts and estate planning. Writing a will for a young couple with children is a pretty common thing that most lawyers who even have a basic understanding of estate law should be able to do for a couple. The difficult thing always in doing that is picking the correct person to be a guardian and to be a trustee. As you said, it's got to be somebody who can say no to the child. It's got to be somebody who can be firm in dealing with sometimes contentious situations where you have a family member who thinks, I wasn't treated fairly by mom or dad. You need somebody to say no and somebody who's got a little bit of a backbone.
Okay, I guess the beginning of all this would be a will. A will is somewhat like a traffic cop that directs the assets to go here, there, or somewhere else.
All a will is, it's a written document that directs the disposition of assets following your death. It can be very simple. It can be extremely complex. I've seen 2-page wills. I've seen 200-page wills. It really can address any concerns that you have. Now, the important thing to remember is a will doesn't become effective until after you die. You can write it now, and you can change it anytime you want. So it's important to have a will, but for most folks, they use a will to direct the distribution of their assets following their death. And many times what I tell many federal employees is that it's probably more important for them to have powers of attorney than it is to have a will. Powers of attorney appoint somebody to step in and manage your affairs if you become incapacitated, or to make medical decisions for you if you lose the ability to make those decisions. If you don't have powers of attorney, the only way somebody can get the authority to act on your behalf is to go to court and seek to be appointed a guardian. And although I've been a lawyer for over 30 years, I think the worst way in the world to solve any problem is to get a court involved to help you do it. That's why it's important to have powers of attorney. Now, if you don't have a will, the primary purpose of a will for many people is to direct how their assets get distributed. And even if you don't have a will, many people have already taken steps to do that. For example, federal employees designate beneficiaries for all their job-related benefits, their thrift plan, their federally life insurance, their pension. All of those beneficiary designations supersede your will anyway. Many people own assets jointly with their spouse or a significant other, and when you die, those assets go to your surviving joint owner. So in many cases, if you don't have a will, your assets are going to be distributed in accordance with your wishes anyway.
Before we went on air, we were talking about check engine lights on cars.
Should there be a
check will light that pops up, or powers of attorney every 2 years, 3 years, 5 years?
It's certainly a good idea. First of all, everybody should do it. People come to me and say, I don't have any money. I don't need a will. Well, maybe you don't need a will, but you certainly need powers of attorney. And in all likelihood, you do need a will. As I said, to go back to our young couple with a child, they need a will, even if they have no money at all, to name a guardian for their children. Now, once you do a will, it's advisable to review it periodically because circumstances change. The person who previously had been a very close friend maybe has moved away. They've got a new job and moved out of the area, or maybe their family circumstances have changed. Maybe you picked your sister or your brother to be the guardian of your child, and they've gone through a divorce, and they're having a difficult time handling their own problems, and they wouldn't be in a position to care for a minor child. Sometimes people have health problems, and because of that can no longer function in the capacity you initially thought that they would. So it is good to look at these things every couple of years.
Well, yeah, this might tie in with when we get the financial planners on the show. They go, well, you just don't set it and forget it. You have to look at it at least annually. Now, this is the financial side of life. Maybe it's semi-annually with the wills and power of attorneys, and or a light bulb needs to go off. Uh-oh, there's been a change in my new best friend.
Well, my experience is when somebody regularly deals with a financial planner, Financial planners tell them, look, you probably should come see us at least annually, maybe quarterly. And my clients tell me all the time, I'm here because my financial planner told me I needed to take a look at this. They are getting guidance. They're getting prodded by their financial planner to look into what they've done and consider whether any changes are necessary.
Okay. Last week we had Dr. Michael Creedon on, and he was talking about caring for elderly parents and the like. And in a family situation, some family members might be more inclined to do it than not. But he was mentioning, if we have a power of attorney, can they then say, okay, Sam or Sally, it's your year? Or, I mean, they can say it. Sam or Sally don't have to agree to it to take care of the parents if they otherwise weren't in a nursing home.
You're absolutely right. I guess point number one, the most important point to make, is you really have no legal obligation to take care of your parents. You don't have to pay for their nursing home care. You don't have a legal obligation to assist them if they need it. Most people take that obligation on freely, number one, because they love their parents, number two, because they feel they have a moral obligation. Now, the only person who has a right to designate an agent under a power of attorney is the parent. So the kids can't say, okay, I've done it for a year, I want you to do it for the next year. They can do that if mom or dad has written that into the power of attorney, but that's not typically the case. Usually, an individual says, I want, and they name a specific individual to be my agent under a power of attorney, and that person, assuming they agree to accept that responsibility, is then responsible for doing it. And if they do it, they've got a fiduciary obligation to act in the best interest of the individual who's given them the power of attorney.
Okay, we started off at a very young age in life, and sometimes young people, myself included, who needs a will? This person had asked, pretty sharp, so they wanted to do it earlier on. But now let's move out a few years, maybe not mid-career, but pre-mid-career. We followed your advice early on, and now things have changed. Maybe we're not married, maybe we are married, maybe there's a significant other. But now we've got some assets. Our earning power is greater than what it was 10 years ago. Maybe we bought a house. Maybe we haven't bought a house. Maybe it's underwater. Maybe it's not. When you sit down with somebody like and say, okay, I need a tune-up, what kind of plugs do I use?
Well, generally what I tell people is the young person with a child is certainly prudent in getting a basic estate plan in place, if for no other reason than to appoint a guardian for their children. Then things change as you go through life, as you indicated. And usually what I tell people are the trigger points to look to see whether you need to revise your plan. Has there been a change in your family situation? Have you had more children? Is the person you've appointed to serve as guardian no longer in a position to do that? Has there been a change in your personal situation? Have you gotten married? Have you gotten divorced? Has somebody died? Has somebody new been born? Has a sibling who you previously named to serve as guardian gotten married? Does that change your view as to whether or not they should be a guardian? Many people, as they get older, you're right, their earning power increases, their wealth increases. Maybe it becomes necessary to take a look at estate tax planning. And in this area, in the Washington, D.C. metro area, two of the three states have state estate taxes. And if the total value of your assets is more than $1 million, you need to at least think about estate tax planning, because there are many steps you can take to minimize estate tax planning. The other thing I want to mention about estate taxes, at the federal level right now, the first $5 million in assets is exempt from tax. So except for people who have assets of more than $5 million, tax planning is not essential. For anybody who does have assets more than that, they certainly need to do some tax planning. That's the good news. But the bad news is the estate tax laws are scheduled to change at the end of next year, at the end of 2012. And unless Congress does something after January 1st, 2013, the federal estate tax exemption reverts to $1 million. Now, I'm fully aware $1 million is a lot of money. But I regularly deal with people who live in major metropolitan areas. If they own a home that they've had for a while, and they have a little bit of life insurance, and they have a little bit of money in the thrift plan, and they're covered by either CSRS or FERS, they may well live paycheck to paycheck, but have a paper estate tax worth of more than $1 million. So it's a good idea not to just dismiss the fact that, oh, the estate tax only applies to rich people. Because if many people look at how the Internal Revenue Code defines rich, they may well find that they're in that category.
Excellent point. Yep. Excellent point. As we move further then out, pre-retirement, after retirement, things really have changed. If there are children, hopefully they're grown by then and they're on their own. Maybe we have a spouse, maybe we don't. Let me go back to that. Divorce earlier on. I thought of that while you were talking. Divorce earlier on, mid-career or early career, and our spouse was our beneficiary of our thrift. And we just didn't think about it. And we had too many other things to think about. And that's not good, is it?
No, it's not. And as a matter of fact, there was a Supreme Court case. It's been about 5 or 6 years ago now, where a former spouse was the designated beneficiary of a retirement plan. This was not a federal employee, but they were the beneficiary of a qualified retirement plan. And under the law of the state where the divorce took place, when you got a divorce, that automatically terminated any beneficiary designations. So the man never bothered to change his beneficiary designation. His ex-wife was the beneficiary of his retirement plan. But a year after the divorce, he was killed in an automobile accident, and his ex-wife filed a claim for benefits. To make a long story short, the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, this is a pension plan. It is governed by federal law. Under federal law, your pension benefits pass to your designated beneficiary. That supersedes state law, which said divorce terminates beneficiary designations. So the point that I make in every seminar that I speak at, for federal employees, your most important estate planning step doesn't need a lawyer. You just need to make sure your beneficiary designations are consistent with your wishes. And you don't do that by going to a lawyer. You do it by going to your human resources office and making sure all of your beneficiary designations, not only for your thrift, but for your Fegley life insurance and your any benefits you're entitled to by virtue of your federal employment, you need to make sure your beneficiary designations are consistent with your wishes. And certainly, if you're getting a divorce, that should be something that's done as part of the divorce.
All righty. For those of y'all listening, I shouldn't be the only one asking this guy a question. So give us a call, and you can talk to Tom. Tom is available now. It's 10:24 Eastern Time, Monday, August 15th, and we're on till 10:57 and a half Eastern Time. If you're listening to this archived, or if it's oftentimes replayed, don't call us. But please do at 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Now, after we're done, between now and then, I'll give you a website that you can ask us questions. But right now, you can get us live. Okay, and it's not only the wills and estate. Tom's an expert in taxes. I know a little bit about taxes and finances, so we're going to be talking about that for the remainder of the show as well. Okay, so I think we marched through the various stages.
If I may, Bob, I would like to sort of elaborate a little bit on when I usually see people to do wills. Usually the first time I see somebody is when they have a new baby and they realize the importance of naming somebody to serve as guardian for that child. Then the next time is usually when that person is getting ready to retire. They've named a guardian for little Johnny, and little Johnny is now 35 years old. But they're retiring, and they've been reading, they've been to retirement seminars, and they know it's time to revise their estate plan. Another time when people come see me all the time is they will call me and say, Tom, I'm getting on a plane next week, and I really want to get this done before I get on the plane. And then the final stage when they come is usually when they've got a very bad diagnosis, and they realize that, you know, this is now no longer merely a matter of academic interest. So they look at it again. But it is advisable to review this periodically. I recommend that at a minimum of every 2 to 3 years.
All righty. There was a bullet point we have in our outline on the web. It says clarity and wills. How can you possibly put clarity into wills for people like me?
Well, what you do is say what you mean. Make it as clear as possible. And many times people in the legal profession are accused of not being clear, or they follow the adage that why should I use one paragraph when 35 will suffice. Now, I'm a big proponent of making things as simple as possible, but also addressing all the concerns you have. And really, the only way to do that is generally through experience. Most people are intelligent. They can read these documents and understand them. I had a lady come to me a few weeks ago, and she had what was supposed to be a relatively simple trust. It was 185 pages long. And she said, I don't understand it. I said, well, talk to the lawyer who drafted it. She said, well, I suggested that he explain some things to me, and he didn't understand them either. And apparently what he had done is he had bought some standard form package that dealt with every possible contingency. It dealt with the property she owned in California. And I said, where's the property you own in California? She said, I've never been to California in my life. So when you do these things, number one, make sure you understand it and make sure it does what you want it to do. And if it doesn't, tell the lawyer to change it. And if the lawyer says, I don't know how to change it, then you need to find another lawyer. But you really need to understand it. And that's the best advice I can give in making your will clear. Make sure it says what you want it to say.
Okay. If somebody was unclear and they needed to be clear, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, if they wanted to get in touch with me, they could simply give me a call. My office number is 301-762-1600, or they could send me an email, and my email is toroark@milesstockbridge.com, and that's all jammed together in lowercase.
Can you do that again,
letters.
Slow?
Yeah, sure. toroarke at milesstockbridge.com.
Tom T. O'Rourke at milesstockbridge.com. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All righty. Let's switch off. We've covered the wheels, and we were actually going to look at two things today. IRS. Let's take a look at IRS audits. Not that our listening population is anxious about audits, but everybody should be. Why? Congress has appropriated significant amount of money to the IRS to train auditors to audit tax returns. Now, is this a bad thing? Well, only if you're, you know, kind of took too many liberties on your return. But one needs to be aware that they're out there more than they've been for the last 25 years. And maybe it's a good thing, because since they weren't there, people thought that they could take liberties. However, audits come in different flavors. People sometimes mistake the piece of mail, and they said, I'm getting audited. And all it does is, I think they call these things the matching program. Sometimes affectionately call them CP2000, because that's the form. And it says, here's a list of things that we found on our computer that we didn't find on your tax return. And this is simple. I mean, it's not as simple. It's 7 pages, but the heart of it is 3 columns. Here's what's on your return. Here's what's in our records. Here's the difference. Here's what the tax that you would owe on that difference. Now, they don't say, here, you have to pay it. Please get back to us and tell us whether you agree with it or whether you don't. This is not an audit. This could be a simple key punch error by either the company sending something in. It could be something that got duplicated within the process, or it's something that we forgot to put on our return. You know, we forgot about that $25 in interest that we earned in XYZ Bank in Oshkosh. I'm 1,000 pardons. It does not mean you're on the radar screen. It's just an actually very efficient way to make sure people report their income. And it's also, I think, an efficient way to see that the IRS's computers are clicking with the returns. Do you get many of those?
I do get them from time to time, Bob, and that's probably the most common contact that most people have with the IRS. They file their returns, and I think the statistic I have read is that the IRS is able to double check about 90% of the items on your tax return without ever talking to you, and that's because of the document smashing program. Virtually every item that shows up on many individual tax returns is reported to the IRS by two sources, the financial institution that you were dealing with and on your return. For example, if you earn interest at the Bank of America is obligated to tell both you and the IRS how much you earned. And that's true with every financial transaction you enter into. I know on my own personal tax return, the only thing that shows up on that return that's not already reported to the IRS by some third party is whatever charitable contributions I make. All dividends, all interest, all mortgage interest, all state and local income taxes, all contributions to pension plans, all of those things are already reported to the IRS by some third party. Now, if you do your own tax return, or even if you don't, if you hire a CPA, you know that you got to put together a lot of paper. And in doing that, you could make a mistake. You could, instead of writing 21 on a tax return, you could write 12. You could transpose the numbers. By the same token, somebody at the IRS is inputting data into a computer. They can make a mistake. So merely because you get a letter from the IRS doesn't mean you're in trouble. All it means is they've got a question, and you need to respond to it. And usually the best advice I can give to people is when you get a letter like that, respond to it promptly. Keep copies of your response. And if you're wrong, if you just made a mistake, pay them what they say you owe, because you're ultimately going to have to do it. And the longer you leave that liability accumulate, the more interest is going to accumulate on the liability.
Yeah, it's another comment, too. Let's say that there is an error on the return. You need to amend the state tax return as well, because when the IRS does, if they do find something, they will tell the state, not that day, but about 6-8 months later, you'll get a notice from the state saying, well, gee, we noticed that your return was corrected by the IRS. Here's your bill from us. And just easier to knock them both out at the same time if that's an issue. The other thing that this is really small, but there isn't a 1099 requirement if interest is under $10. I mean, this is really teeny. But, you know, we'll have clients and they'll say, well, I didn't get a 1099. And I said, let's just put something down. If we put $9 down, it's much easier to put the $9 down than if you ever are audited. And I'm not remotely suggesting the probability of audits is high, but if they ask you, did you report all your income? Yep, including the $9 that I didn't get a 1099 for. Next question.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one of the first questions that's asked in an audit. Did you report all your income? Now, how do I know that? With regards to the audits that our clients get, I generally am the power of attorney, and I go down and I do the audit. But if somebody went down either without representation or just thought they could do it on their own, that's the first question, one of the first questions that they ask. Why? Because it's unnerving. I didn't put the $25 I got from Aunt Nellie, and then it goes downhill from there.
Well, Bob, I've only ever been audited by the IRS personally once, and it was when I first got out of law school. I worked for the IRS as a trial lawyer, and when IRS hires employees who work in compliance, they audit their returns. That's part of the entry process. Your returns got to be audited. And I went in for a meeting with the auditor, and you're right. The very first question she asked me is, did you have any income that you didn't report on your return? And I was sort of taken aback. I said, does anybody ever answer yes to that question? She says, yes, all the time. And people get in, but it can be a little bit unnerving because you think maybe she knows something you don't. So, but the best advice in all of these dealing with the IRS is be candid, be straightforward, tell the truth, and you'll stay out of trouble.
I agree 100%. They have a very rough job, but they're not bad people. I've really met very few people that abused their power in all these years, but I've met a lot of people that abused their power on the private side too. So,
sure. Well, I will never forget when I started to work as an IRS trial lawyer. My boss told me, Tom, you really don't understand that you have a lot of power. Your job in working for the IRS is to do the right thing. Your job is not to collect the maximum amount of money you can collect. It's to do what's right. And if you're dealing with somebody and you see they've overlooked certain tax benefits, it's your obligation to tell them about that. And that was the one thing that I found very rewarding about working for the IRS. My job was to do what was right, not necessarily the government always wins when you get the right result. And it may be giving somebody a lot of money back.
Okay, then we talked about kind of, let's call this a letter questionnaire as to why your return differed from what they had in their computer. It's amazing to me. I've never seen one where they know what your mortgage interest deduction is, but if you didn't claim enough, that they say, gee, you didn't claim enough, here's a refund. I've never seen one of those.
No,
but,
I haven't either.
But I'm waiting to see one. But again, that's not an audit. But let's say that you do get audited, and let's explain why the chance of getting audited is greater. I didn't say that you're going to get audited, but it's greater than what it's been in the past. We now have something called e-filing. And e-filing is really being pushed by the IRS for efficiency, but also a quick way to check. And then they can match things up without having the key punch for the most part. Not 100%, but for the most part. So if you have a situation then, e-file, you've basically downloaded your return into the computer. And let's just say that you get that threaded, you know, we would like you to come down and explain X, Y, and Z. Now, this is going to sound very self-serving, but unless you really, really feel comfortable with this, you shouldn't go. You should have somebody represent you. Why? Because puts you be somebody else between you and the IRS. Not that anybody should take liberties with that, but it's much easier because the person representing you has done it before and they're not nervous. They're on edge, but they're not nervous, and they've prepared. If you want to do this yourself, it's fine. I find when I deal with an auditor, very frank with them. If I don't know, I don't know, and I say, I'll get back to you, I'll talk to my client, they're fine with that. Everything they ask for is in a manila folder, copies for them if they want. If it's voluminous, it's in different colors, depending on whether it's a rental property or a small business or something like that. And you go, okay, here it is. Here's how I got the numbers. Or if there's an issue, I'll say, here's the issue. We don't need to dig around it. You know, this is messed up. And I think they appreciate it.
They do. From having sat on the other side of the table, you always appreciate candor. Don't assume you're going to fool these people, and don't assume that you're smarter than they are. This is what they do for a living. They know the law. They understand what they're doing for the most part. You do occasionally get some new rookie people that are being trained who don't fully understand the law. But for the most part, you're dealing with somebody whose whole life is to understand the types of issues that they're talking to you about, and they know what they're doing. And be straightforward with them. Don't give them the excuse. Don't take in a big bag of receipts and say, hey, it's all in the bag. Look at it. Just all you have to do is find it. Because most agents I know are going to give it back to you and say, no, it's your obligation to do that, not mine. And if you don't do it, I'm going to assume you can't prove that you're entitled to this tax benefit. So the advice I always give people in dealing with the IRS or anybody else, treat people the way you would like to be treated, with dignity and respect, and don't try to play games with them. But I also do agree with your advice that unless it's a very simple matter, it's advisable to have your CPA perhaps represent you at the audit, because he or she is more likely to understand the law that underlies whatever benefit you claimed. They prepared to return. They understand the issues associated with it. And they, in all likelihood, will be able to handle it more efficiently with IRS.
Yeah. Okay, so if you get one of these notices, and sometimes the notices aren't anything we just talked about. It can be as simple as if somebody files estimated taxes and they didn't put the proper amount down, or they put too much down, and it's very easy to determine, oh, yeah, okay, I didn't write the check that quarter, but I claimed it anyway. You owe it. Or, no, it's wrong, you didn't. Here's a copy of the canceled check. And I've found them the IRS not to be bad with any of this. You know, there's just, I don't think I've ever met an auditor that came in looking to assess X dollars. Years ago, we toured the Philadelphia Service Center a while ago and looked at how they process tax returns. And at the end, the center director sat with us, and it was a group of accountants. And, of course, I raised my hand, and I said, do you keep a profile on tax preparers? And the director looked at me and said, well, of course not. And I go, yeah, right. But, I would think that they would.
Well, what they do now is they do have what they call the tax preparer program. And as anybody who prepares tax returns knows, you've got to put your own identifying number on the tax return. And IRS, on a purely random basis, selects certain returns prepared by a tax return preparer. And if they find consistent errors, there's a good likelihood that all of the returns prepared by that person are going to get kicked out under the identifying number. So it's real important when you're selecting a tax preparer, not necessarily to select a guy who promises you the biggest refund, because many times those people are probably not the best. And in recent years, IRS and Congress have tried to police tax return preparers at least a little bit by requiring them to get a tax preparer number. So hopefully that'll deter people who are outright crooks. And there are plenty of them out there. There are a lot of people have figured out a way to they know that when you file a tax return, IRS usually processes it, sends you a refund relatively quickly, and before they get a chance to really look at the return in detail, you've gotten paid your fee and you're long gone, and the taxpayer is left holding the bag. And that can be a problem. And the other thing is, if you've gone to a tax preparer who wants to be compensated based on the amount of the refund you're going to get, number one, that's against the law. Number two, you're responsible for everything that's on that tax return. Don't think you're going to get away and say to the IRS, well, my tax return preparer told me I could do that. Like the lady that called me a couple years ago wanted to sue her return preparer because he claimed a charitable contribution deduction in a specific amount. And I asked her, I said, where did you get that number? She said, I don't know. He said, that's the amount the IRS gives you. Mm. Well, the IRS didn't give you anything. I said, how much did you contribute to charity? She said, nothing. But he told me I was entitled to claim it anyway. And, of course, IRS had audited her and wanted to assess tax. They disallowed her charitable contribution deductions. And she wanted to sue her preparer. And I said, well, maybe you can recover any interest and penalties you had to pay. But I said, do you know where your preparer is? She said, yeah, he's in jail. I said, well, the chance of recovering anything from him is not significant.
Okay, let's take a tangent. I have a lady that claimed a charitable donation. The lady's a professional. Based on the market value of the service that she provided, and it was heart tugging what she did. You know, morally, you say I'm entitled to this deduction, and came in and said I want to claim this, and I said you can't claim value of services. Otherwise, you know, what's your rate? $10,000 an hour, $100 an hour? You could set it at 10 for the IRS and 100 for the public, and that's why you can't do that. And they felt no, I'm entitled to this. And unfortunately, it had a calling card on it, and the IRS came calling, and the auditor met with the lady and said, listen, I appreciate what you did, but you can't deduct it. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are many times people think they're entitled to deductions because of what they're doing is a good thing. For example, when somebody builds something and donates it to charity and they want to include the value of their services. And that's a real common example of people saying, well, it's just not fair. I should be able to deduct it. And the one thing I always tell them is nobody has ever said the tax code is perfectly fair. And that's just the way it is.
Okay, and hopefully the listening crew will never see an audit, but if you do, don't have heart palpitations. They're more common than they've ever been, and maybe you unfortunately draw the short straw. But if you have good representation or you feel very comfortable doing it, then have at it. Another comment I have that unfortunately has become very clear to me in recent weeks, foreign bank accounts. Now, I'm not talking about the people with Swiss accounts with $8 gazillion in it, but there's a box on your tax return, anybody's tax return, and says, you know, do you have control of a foreign bank account that has more than $10,000 in it? And if you say no, and they find that there is one, then you might get looked at. Now, if you have $11,000 in it, the chances are, if they look at it, there just isn't much to talk about as far as what they could penalize you. But if you do have a whole lot more than that, call somebody, attorney, CPA. Probably an attorney would be better if you've got a lot more in it, because after August 31st, which isn't that far away, the penalties for having one of these things will become pretty rough. Not pretty rough. Awful rough.
Yeah. Bob, as you and I and anybody who works in the field of taxation know, you get emails both from the IRS and from companies that want to educate you on the various issues that are being looked into. And clearly, the most common article or announcement or pronouncement that I see relates to foreign bank accounts. IRS believes, and with some justification, that there are people who have significant amounts of money in foreign banks and they are not reporting the income from those accounts. So they've developed a program and they've had some cooperation from particularly a number of Swiss banks. And for people who do have foreign bank accounts, not only Switzerland but anywhere else, these same rules apply. And as Bob said, if you have more than $10,000, you've got to report that on your tax return. Now, what I've seen from looking at a number of tax returns, that's a question at the bottom of the schedule. I believe it's Schedule B or Schedule A.
B.
Schedule B, where you report your dividends and interest. It's a question right at the bottom of the form. Do you have signature authority over a foreign bank account with $10,000? And many people never bother to, they just omit it. They ignore it altogether. It's not that they just think it doesn't apply to them, so they just forget about it. You really do need to check one box or the other and make sure you do it accurately when you report it. And if you do have more than $10,000 in a bank account anywhere, Canada is a foreign country, so you need to report an account you may have in Canada or Mexico or anywhere else.
Good. Okay, we'll leave that, and let's just circle back. We're going into 2012 and 5 months, 4 months, and at the end of 2012, there's the meeting of the minds as to changing the tax law. We had they call them the Bush tax rates. I'm very apolitical here, but the prior Bush presidency ushered in a steep cut in the highest rates. And they were to expire, what, at the end of 2010?
Right.
And Congress said, listen, we need 2 years to look at this because we've got a lot of other budgetary things we need to be concerned with and the like. So by the end of next year, there are going to be some changes. And you read about, you know, this thing's going to be on the chopping block. And everything's on the chopping block. It's just, you know, where will they compromise? I mean, it can be mortgage interest deduction. I'm not saying that they're going to knock it out, but for those that might have very high mortgages, one of the things they're looking at is that. I'm not saying get unnerved by my comment, but just kind of follow it in the papers. So when you're doing tax planning, some of the things that used to be primary aren't going to be primary.
That's the one thing that makes planning very difficult. You need to be aware that the laws could change. Now, the last time we sounded this alarm was during 2010 because the so-called Bush tax cuts were going to expire, the rates were going to go up, dividends and capital gains were going to be taxed at a higher rate, the estate tax laws were going to change, and everybody was speculating on what's going to happen, and Congress just punted for 2 years. They extended the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years. Now, as we've all seen, there's been very little agreement in Congress about anything. And what's ultimately going to happen with the tax code is kind of up in the air, and it wouldn't shock me at all if there will be a lame duck session after the 2012 elections where Congress comes back and does something on an interim basis. That could well happen. But as Bob mentioned, there have also been some fairly extensive discussions about a dramatic reform of the tax code. And anytime there's a discussion of that, they always focus on the two, quote, loopholes that most people really don't consider loopholes that cost us the most tax revenue. And those two loopholes are the mortgage interest deduction and the fact that the health insurance that's paid for you by your employer should be taxable income. Now, those are benefits that affect most all of us. If you own a home and you have a mortgage, or if you have health insurance, those are two things that could affect us significantly. Now, as Bob said, we have no idea as to whether or not that's even seriously being considered. But it is something that's proposed or at least discussed on a fairly regular basis. So probably the best watchword is you need to stay alert in doing your tax planning. And this is the type of thing you need to revisit on a periodic basis, particularly as we get closer to the end of 2012.
Yes, and sometimes when they do reform, they make it harder. It's hard for me to fathom that the return could get any harder for the average plus return. It's just hard. And if sometimes when they simplify things, I remember in 1986, the Reagan cuts, and they got rid of a lot of the little things, credit card interest and things like that. And in its place, they cut the tax rates. And I promise you, I said this to Nancy. I said, Nancy, I'm not going to have a job anymore doing tax work. I'm going to have to sell computers, and I don't understand computers. And the return is now easily 20 times harder than what it was in 86.
Well, Bob, I remember when I first started to practice law, there was a standard volume that most tax professionals would use called the Commerce Clearinghouse Standard Federal Tax Reports. And it came in a series of loose-leaf binders. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I believe there were six binders that covered everything, the tax code, the regulations, a summary of court cases, and it was six volumes long. Before it went to being available exclusively in a CD or online, it had grown to 22 volumes. And that was after the tax code had been simplified in 1976 and 1981. Every time Congress simplifies the tax code and makes it fairer, it gets more difficult to administer. It gets more difficult to comply with the requirements. One provision that's supposed to help people who have low income, the earned income tax credit, it's designed to help people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum. Well, if you ever try to fill out the darn form, it's amazingly complex. And I think it's the one form that is the most frequently filed improperly. And that's for things that are supposed to be really easy. So in all likelihood, if Congress does simplify the tax code, your job of filing your tax return is going to get more difficult.
And I'll have to narrow my scope. But also with this change, they're going to change the estate law, correct? I mean, doesn't the estate law get changed with the income tax law?
Absolutely. There are going to be significant changes in the estate tax law. As what was supposed to happen in 2011 was the estate tax was supposed to, well, in 2010, the estate tax did go away altogether. However, for people who died in 2010, they still can't file their estate tax return, which would have been due as early as September 2010. They can't file those returns because IRS has not been able to publish the regulations that implement the law that didn't pass until the end of December 2010. So for people who died in January 2010, we still don't know how to apply the law, and this is not a slam at IRS. Congress didn't change the law until the end of the year. And they told IRS, well, just make it easy. And it's just an impossible job for them to deal with.
Okay, one of the provisions that I think would impact virtually anybody listening, under current estate law, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tom. Let's say I inherit a share of stock from Uncle George or Aunt Nellie, and that stock is worth $15 a share. but they only paid $5 a share for it. And I think they call this the step-up rule, so that when I inherit it, I'm considered to have paid $15 a share, the market value at the date that they passed. There's some rumbling that that might not find its way into the new law.
That I've heard the same rumblings, but twice in the past they have repealed stepped-up basis, your ability to claim that step-up from $1 to $15 in your example. And in both times, the IRS found it so difficult to administer and to write regulations that they abandoned the change in the law, and Congress went back to the step-up in basis. Whether or not that'll be part of any tax reform is just really anybody's guess. But a fairly common problem that I deal with is when I talk to an individual who's bought a stock and they're getting ready to sell it and they want to know, how's this going to affect my taxes? I said, well, what did you pay for it? They said, I have no idea. And it gets much more difficult if you're dealing with a stock that you inherited. You have no idea what the person who purchased that stock may have paid for it.
All righty, Tom. Final, we covered a lot of stuff here. Final comments within, we got less than a minute.
Okay. Well, as far as estate planning goes, everybody needs to give it some thought. Everybody needs a basic will at a minimum. Everybody also needs financial and medical powers of attorney to allow somebody to act on your behalf if you become incapacitated. And as far as the tax law goes, the best advice I can give you, stay tuned, keep reading the papers, keep listening to the show, and you can rest assured that we'll be discussing these matters as changes are implemented.
That's right. And thanks for listening. Any questions that you didn't want to ask, but you can ask on an email for FOR, your, Y-O-U-R, benefit, at NITPINC.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be on next week with John Elliott talking about the best of. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.